Hello.
Morning, everyone.
Hey, okay, let's see, who's who? Thomas?
That's me.
Hey, Thomas. And Maurice?
Yep, that's me.
Hey, we are all here. Again, thank you guys for doing this. This is going to be a lot of fun. Now, I'll be honest, this is like the maybe first or second time I've done an audio interview. So I'm probably a little rough around the edges about it, but we'll try and make it fun.
Okay.
And I'm also kind of getting over a cold still, so I'm going to try.
Make us sound even better.
So I'm going to try and keep the sneezing and coughing to a minimum. So
who's the other guy in the interview? Maurice somebody or other?
I think his name is the cow.
Cow.
What? Is that an in-joke of some type?
Yes, it's been a running gag with us for 20-plus years. That's why it was moo at the beginning of the conversation.
Okay, well, if you don't mind, I'm just going to kind of jump right in. So we kind of, Maurice, thank you again for kind of helping put this together. I got to say, one of the joys about doing this blog I'm doing is being able to talk to guys like you. And when I first saw your comment on my little YouTube video, I audibly squeed. I will not lie. I audibly squeed. because I was like, oh, my God. but it's really a joy to be able to talk to the people who make these games. And this is actually... I plan on playing all the PC space games. I don't know if you guys saw that on my blog, but I plan on playing all of them. So it's well over 1,000 games. And this is the first time I'm actually talking to developers from a classic game, not like a current game. So this is kind of doubly exciting.
Well, you've already peaked. How do you top this, right?
It's going to be very, very difficult, but got to move forward. Got to try at least. You got to make that effort. But I kind of wanted to start first, before we get into at least the rules of engagement series, to kind of talk maybe a little bit about the universe series, which is kind of where everything began, if I'm correct.
Yeah, indeed it did. And so during the course of this interview, this is going to be an exercise in my memory, which is a little bit foggy on a lot of this. It's been so long. But that's why I was looking forward to this mostly, is just to jog my memory on some of the things that had happened in the past. I was going through the, I know we'll jump into it a little bit later, but I was thumbing through the Rules of Engagement manual earlier today, and I was like, wow, I totally forgot about a lot of this. I actually want to play this game.
It's a lot of fun. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult game.
Yeah, I played it again the first time in a while. I played both Rules 1 and Rules 2 through DOSBox the other day, and I looked at it and I went, how do I do that again?
Oh my God, that's bad. But it's funny. I actually have snagged copies of all three Universe games. And so I'm looking at the manual for the first one right now, and there is just a ton of detail in here. And I read on Wikipedia that this was started with, what was the gentleman's name? William Leslie, and it was based on a board game?
Yeah, I saw that in your notes. You know, I had totally forgotten that he had actually created a board game initially.
Oh.
So pretty much, you know, the credit for the Universe game really has to go to Bill Leslie. I mean, that was originally his idea. I was not doing games at the time, so it was his thought that, you know, we get together and try to do this as a computer game. I had already started my computer business. I was still in college at the time. I was sort of going to college half time and the other half time trying to run my company, which was just, you know, doing local programming, or I should say programming for local businesses. But he had approached me with the idea of doing this computer game, and I thought it sounded kind of cool. So we jumped into it, but like anything, it seems like anything we did with the computer games, we jumped into it with both feet and didn't quite know where we were getting into. And I think we spent almost a year working on that before it was released.
Wow.
And we kind of went all out with it. Actually, do you have the, Brian, do you have the original Universe packaging or the re-release universe
I packaging? Honestly don't know. The manual I'm holding in my hand is spiral bound, and it says DOS, well, the book says 1984 Omnitrans Universe, DOS 3.3, 1979, printed in the United States of America.
Yeah, that's the since it's spiral bound, it's the re-release manual. The original Universe manual was in a three-ring binder.
That's the one I've been trying to find. I thought it was. I was like, wait a minute. I thought the original was in a three-ring binder, and
I'm holding one right here.
Oh, it's very difficult to find. I've been scouring eBay and Amazon for years for it, and I feel lucky to have found this. I guess it's a re-release now. But it's still just reading these manuals is insanely entertaining because of all the detail. Yeah, they don't make them like this anymore. But so it took you guys a year to translate the board game into basically what I'm holding in my hand?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we started in 83, and then it was released in 84. The original packaging was big, you know. It was a big 8.5 by 11 binder, and then we released I think we called it the complete product guide, which I think came with the re-release package. It may have been bound in with the spiral manual, but it was sort of an add-on to Universe that had details on all of the products that you could buy and sell.
There is an appendix that has a lot of information in it. I don't know if that's... Oh, there is a product list here. Yeah, that might be...
Yeah. Yeah, I thought we had integrated that, right?
Oh, my God.
Now, this is where my memory gets to be a little bit foggy as far as where Maurice came into the picture. Maurice, can you...
Oh, I can tell you when that is. That's a breach, so...
The first breach?
Yeah.
Breach Amiga. That's where I come in. Oh, so wow. You go and talk about Universe, and we'll come in after Universe 2.
Oh, so you came in after Universe 2.
Yeah, so please, continue about Universe. I'll sip my coffee and listen to the stories.
Well, I hope you don't mind. I kind of wanted to give it a whole well-rounded thing, because I'll be honest.
No, go ahead.
I never played any of these. I got my first like DOS computer in 85, so I missed these. I'll be perfectly honest with you. They were a little before my time. But part of the joy of doing this blog, and part of the thing I'm most excited about, is going back and planning on playing all of these again. So I guess my next question is: Do you have any tips on how to play these? Because they look crazy complicated.
that was my thought when I was going through the Rules of Engagement manual earlier today. This manual is 212 pages. This is pretty complicated.
I love these. I did an article way back on what I think are the best manuals for computer space games, and the Rules of Engagement series jointly won the top spot because they're.
As I recall, I wrote the bulk of the manual for the first one up to the sections where it goes into all the details on the ships and everything, and all the stuff at the back, and then Jim Shelton did the rewrite for Rules of Engagement 2 largely. I actually have my Rules of Engagement original manual from the first game it's all marked up with the notes for doing the second manual. So it's got sections crossed out, and there's little questions written in the margins, like, what about this and what about that?
That's amazing.
We also did all of the manuals ourselves too. We did the layout in PageMaker.
Oh yeah, that was all you.
Yeah. Well, I can still remember, you know, there are very specific memories that I have back from doing the computer games. One of them was we became an Apple developer so that we could do the Apple versions of the games. And I very specifically remember going to Cupertino, to Apple's headquarters, for some meetings, and it was the first time I got to see a laser printer. Apple was just finishing up work on their laser writer.
Wow.
And we were drooling over that because we wanted it to be able to do the layout of the manual.
How big was it?
We wound up purchasing one. And that was probably about in the Universe 2 days. Yeah, probably like round 85, I think. I'm trying to remember the order of the games. I'm not really sure. There, Universe 1 and Universe 2, that was clear. Universe 3 came later, though.
I remember it was Universe 1, Universe 2, you guys then released Breach, and then Universe 3 was between that and Paladin.
Didn't Paladin before Universe 3?
I believe it was. I'm just trying to remember. No, yeah, you're correct, because I did the last version of Breach for the Amiga, and then we did Paladin right after, which you showed at CES in January of 88.
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a photo of us at CES.
I was just graduating middle school at the time. Oh, my God. But what? Yeah, I'm looking.
That makes me feel really good.
Sorry, guys. Sorry, but it is fascinating to hear all these stories. Yeah, I'm looking at the list of the games in Moby Games right now. And Universe 3 came out in '89.
Yeah,
3 years after Universe 2. So there was apparently Breach in the middle of those two.
Breach and Paladin.
Universe 3 would have been the last game that Bill Leslie had worked on. He and I parted ways, as I recall, early in the development of that game. Maurice and I finished that one up ourselves.
Okay. Now, the Universe games, they're more like open-ended, more like, because I haven't played them yet, but what I'm reading on the manual, they seem more like open-y, like elite-type games, but just with a lot more functional detail in how you fly and everything.
Yeah, they morphed considerably. The first Universe game was very much strategy. The second Universe game took all of the elements from Universe 1 and added a text adventure to it.
Oh, really?
So as you would go down on planet side, you would go into this text adventure mode.
Oh, yeah, I see that on the box here. It's going to be fun.
There were, I believe all of the commands and controls were text-based, but I think there were graphics. Is that right, Maurice?
Yeah, there were graphics. Yeah. I remember they were in 640 by 200 mode.
Oh, wow. And then, yeah.
As I recall, Universe 3 actually deviated even more towards the adventure side, which...
Yeah, because it had the point-click verb interface and all that.
Yeah,
I actually have a lot of the artwork for it still. I keep everything, so I have all the art pieces for almost all the games, so I can look at all the interface elements and everything. I know Tom has them all archived somewhere.
Yeah, I am looking at the box right now for Universe 3, and it does look a little different than the other two.
Yeah, I'm looking at the screenshots from it right now.
Oh my gosh. So, okay, so what was the impetus to switch from the Universe games to the Rules of Engagement games? Because from what it looks like, they're pretty, even though they take place in the same universe, they're pretty different.
Gee, I have to say, I have no recollection of how the idea for Rules of Engagement came about. You, Maurice?
I sort of do, because I remember what happened was when I met you guys, you had just done Breach and you were showing it off at the Atari Expo in Worcester, Mass. And that's how we met. And they hadn't done the Amiga version yet, and they saw some animation I'd done and were interested in me doing graphics for the games. So I suggested that I do, as a sort of a test for both sides, that I do the Amiga version of Breach so that they could see if they liked my work and I could see if I liked working with them. And then... What I remember talking to you guys was that you had done this, the boarding sequence in Universe 2, and you made that into its own game to make Breach. Is that correct, Tom?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then the idea was to sort of do the same thing. You took the space combat thing and made a separate game out of that, with the idea of using the interlocking game system sort of build a universe game out of multiple games, sort of. Something like that. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Brian, you're aware of the interlocking game system and how the games were designed to work with each other?
Oh, absolutely. Now, where did that come from? Because that's something that really hasn't been done since, for the most part, which is sad. I mean, not a lot of space games have boarding actions, but especially they don't have boarding actions that take it to that level of detail.
Yeah, I think just what Maurice had said, I think it was just born of the idea that you know, it'd be nice to flesh out the whole space combat thing into its own game and detail that, and then take all the elements from Breach, or from the boarding sequence of Universe 2, and spin that off into Breach, and then allow the two games to work with each other so that as you would go from Rules of Engagement in a boarding sequence, it would go right into Breach if you had both games installed.
And I did back in the day, and I spent hours playing, doing the boarding actions. I spent hours just playing both of these games to death. But I was better at them back then, from what I remember. If I don't know if you watch the videos, but I'm a terrible fleet commander. Absolutely horrible.
Remember, you gotta look at the map. That's what I
know. I keep forgetting to look at the map. I'm so, like, I have such target fixation on, like, what my one little ship is doing that I forget that, hey, there are other ships out there. But one thing that drew me, I must admit, to the Rules of Engagement games initially was the interface and how similar it was to the Lacar's system on Star Trek The Next Generation, which I was and still am a huge fan of. How did that get born? It was called Lacar in the game, right? LYCAR, I believe?
No, actually, on Star Trek, it's, you know, LCARS, right, which is Library Computer Access Retrieval System or something like that. The actual interface is CCSI, which I think is Command and Control Systems Interface.
Oh.
And CCSI-2 in the sequel. In fact, if you look in the manual, it's described that way. The LICAR thing you see is actually a joke. It's Tom's wife's name. It's Lynn Carbone.
Okay.
A lot of the panels have... They did this on Star Trek The Next Generation. A lot of the panels have the first two letters of somebody's first name and the first three letters of their last name stuck on buttons. So as a joke, I did that on some of the panels in the first Rules of Engagement game. So,
oh, really?
So Tom's wife is all over the game. So
that's hilarious. But yeah, where did that come from, Star Trek The Next Generation? Did you want to make it similar to that so it would have more of an appeal? Like, because it worked on me. But where did that that idea come from?
Well, you know, from my recollection, sort of that was kind of the idea. But when I sat down to actually look at it, it didn't really work. You know, it's a very nice looking piece of artwork to have actors tap their fingers on. But when you really get down to it, there is no functional organization. You can't tell one thing from another. You can't tell a control from a readout. So I ended up sort of starting with that idea and then trying to simplifying it down to something that actually worked. And one of the key things there was coming up with the idea of color coding the instruments so that there are two kinds of buttons. There are action buttons and selection buttons, and they're always the same color.
Oh.
So you can always pick the controls out. So the purple things do something, and the blue things select something. And every other color is not an interactive element. It's usually, like, you know, a readout.
Oh, I never noticed that. That's very
cool. And in the second game, there we changed it because magenta we had to use because of EGA, so that's the hot pink buttons. When we got the Rules of Engagement 2, they became kind of gold because I couldn't stand looking at magenta anymore after doing EGA and CGA graphics for so much time.
Yeah, but the level of...
So the defining element in that interface very quickly is what I call the inverse L bracket, which is you know, a bar at the top and a bar on the side. Because we'd had so low resolution, you couldn't really make a box around it. So generally, you just put a bar on, you know, top and side to sort of frame this group of controls goes together. Or what I call a curly bracket, which just, you know, connects a bunch of items together with a stem that can move to whatever button it's connected to. And that's really what most of it is.
Well, I got to say, it works pretty well. I mean, at first, it's even reading the manual, it's a bit it is a bit overwhelming. But once you kind of get the flow of the whole thing and how everything kind of works together, it really is kind of a masterful system. I mean, there sadly have not been a lot of capital ship sims in the space gaming realm. I can maybe think of a handful. But this probably has the most detailed interface of any of them. And I think it's one of the great game's greatest legacies, honestly. is the interface.
Well, I have to say the thing that impresses me every time I look at the game is really the under-the-hood stuff. It's all the AI going on for the captains and everything. We had a lot of fun early on the first game just putting different captains on ships and seeing what they would do. And, you know, and you'd make their personalities really extreme, and then they wouldn't obey your orders, and they'd go off and do crazy crap. And it was just hilarious to see what you could create happening, and you actually couldn't control the situation if you did it wrong.
I have to say the AI is insanely impressive, because there were a few times I just wanted to test it out where I would do a mission and I would find a captain that, like, had an alcohol problem and didn't really like commanders who had less experience than they did. And so I put them in charge of a small little task group, and I tried to give them an order, and they just kind of went off and did their own thing. I was like, oh, you son of a... But that's awesome that it does that. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, that's all Tom. I take no credit for that. So
that's actually my fondest memory of working on Rules of Engagement, Rules of Engagement 2. When Maurice first approached me about the idea of doing this interview, that was the first thing that popped to mind. I remember working on it very vividly. In those days, I had a second terminal. It wasn't just a monitor. It was like an ANSI terminal.
Okay.
So that you could, you know, it was like... 80 columns and 24 lines, but it could take ANSI commands, so you could actually position the cursor at different points in the screen.
Huh.
So it wasn't graphics. You still were dealing with ASCII characters, but you could still move the cursor around. You could highlight things. And I had that terminal connected to the computer through a serial port, and then the diagnostics in the program would send information to that terminal so that it would basically create a grid of the ship captains and what their thought processes, so to speak, were.
Oh, wow.
So that as I would tweak the AI, I could see exactly what was sort of going on in the minds of those particular captains. That was a lot of fun to work on, and a lot of work went into it. I think it doesn't necessarily show a read through of the manual, but there's some pretty sophisticated AI in there.
Yeah, I could tell because, like, there'll be times in the videos and outside the videos where, like, I would try and tell certain captains to do certain things, and they would do something else based on what was going on immediately around them. And I always thought that kind of thing, that kind of situational awareness, that kind of reactive nature of the AI was always impressive.
Yeah, I remember we were doing some of the mission design, and I had Jim Shelton working on this with me. And we figured out some things about making some of the captains rather extreme. And I remember one of the missions specifically, you're ordered to go capture a particular ship. And the first time he play tested it, he's engaging, giving orders, and suddenly it says, you failed your mission. And he looked, and the target ship he was supposed to capture had been destroyed. Because this one captain, she was set where she was really just very headstrong, and she just took off and destroyed it and disobeyed orders. So we figured out ultimately in that one, the only strategy that worked was to immediately attack her ship, blow her engines out so she couldn't screw up your mission. So you had to attack your own captain and take her engines out in order to finish the mission.
Oh, God. That's terrible. That's absolutely horrible.
I think that mission's actually in there. I think we toned it down a little, but that's actually the best strategy for that one. I'll find out which one it is, and I'll tell you.
Okay. Yeah, because I got to be honest, that game kicked my butt.
There's one other one like that too, where the simplest way to finish it, because you have to take out 70% of the enemy fleet in a matter of minutes.
I think I
pick your most loyal captain. You head him right into the middle of the enemy formation and order him to self-destruct, and he takes out almost all of them.
See, I never would have thought of that, but that's an amazing yet terrible strategy.
that was Jim's idea. He's a sick man that way.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Jim's actually still in the game industry. He was actually in high school when he did those missions for me and worked on the manuals. And he's actually the design director at Namco Bandai Games mobile division. So if you have mobile phone games, you have that stuff, you may have something of his current.
Wow. I mean, so, you guys are still both in the gaming industry, right?
Well, I am. Tom left me.
But Tom,
I got out of the gaming industry. Let's see, the last game was Rules of Engagement 2, right, Maurice?
Yep.
Yeah.
Because you licensed Reach 3, and that was the last thing.
It was a problem for me because the industry had grown up so much that it was almost impossible to develop a game sort of with one or two people anymore and compete and market. And so I think it was with Breach 2. What was the first product that went to Minecraft, Maurice? Was that Breach 2?
I think so. Didn't it go to one company, then it was Impressions published the second one, or vice versa?
Oh, I totally forgot about Impressions. Yeah, yeah. So there were two companies that we worked through. The first was Minecraft, and then it was Impressions.
Right, yeah. Impressions did Breach 3 and Rules of Engagement 2, apparently. And Minecraft did Breach 2 and the first Rules of Engagement, apparently.
Right.
Yeah, what I recall was that the industry, you know, it used to be there were mom-and-pop computer stores, so I remember that Breach was so successful that Tom bought himself a very, very nice car, which I've had the pleasure of riding in. a Lotus Esprit Turbo, as I recall.
Whoa.
And then the market changing, all the mom and pop computer stores dried up, and then you had to try to get into the eggheads of the world.
Oh, egghead.
Companies like that, they want inventory control, so they want you to have a certain number of titles per year so that they have excess inventory, you trade them out. And if you're a small publisher, you can't do that because you don't make that kind of you don't make that many games. So it's very hard to get on their shelves, so you have to partner with somebody, which is, I think, why you went with Minecraft, if I'm remembering Tom.
Yeah, that's right. And they were struggling in those days themselves. And of course, you know, you have to surrender a little bit of control. You know, they want to have some control over the content of the game. They want to have a lot of control over the packaging and the artwork. And it became less and less of a fun thing to do and more of a business.
Mm.
And just found that the industry was changing, and the kinds of games that I wanted to do weren't the ones that were selling well. So I just thought, you know, now's the time to quit.
Oh.
So
it seems to have kind of come full circle now. Because now you have all these indie developers with these little space games, these medium-sized space games. That's just one or two guys, like you said earlier. And now you have all these little indie games coming out that look fantastic. Because it's funny, when I started this blog, I thought I'd be mostly looking at the classics and with the occasional new release, because there weren't a lot of space games coming out. But there are so many little indie titles now, with just one or two people behind them, that it's just a fascinating time to be a space gamer. Have you guys...
I think that again goes back to the how the market changed, because with the internet, and then with channels like on mobile, where you can get something on the iTunes store or Android Marketplace or whatever, you know, the distribution isn't the problem it was for us at that point, because you have direct access into people, you know. And then it's really a matter of discoverability, and so people can find your game. But there's very little cost in getting the game out there, which in our case was very different, because look at all the packaging and, you know, all the discs and, cost of goods and perceived value when you pick up the box and all that stuff. So it's a different world.
Yeah, that's probably one of the few things I miss, is being able to, like, go into Egghead or Stop and Save Software and just pick up a nice big box and feel how heavy it is and look and read the back of it and just get a idea about, you know, how the game might have felt
before. I think the problem with Rules of Engagement was it took a forklift to pick up the sequel because there's so many manuals in it.
I gotta say, I love that. I love that there are three freaking manuals to this game. The builder, the training, and the fleet operations. I just love that.
I remember the funny story I remember about the manuals was that I don't remember who was supposed to do the cover design for the manual. But the last minute, Tom called me, and they didn't have the cover, and they needed a cover, and the cover that you see on the Fleet Operations Manual, I put together in, I think, 45 minutes, and I just zapped it over to him so he could get the things printed.
Was this Rules 1 or Rules 2?
This was Rules 1, because Rules 2, it's the same design, basically.
Yeah.
But it was just like, we'd already had the Federated Worlds logo and stuff, but I had to slap it together. And we had all the little logos for all the the company. So, of course, there's a logo on the back for the Scion Group and with the registered mark of the Scion Group, you know, and printed on Cetus Amicus, which is still a planet I cite to this day. But that's another story.
I'm looking at that right now. I actually kind of like the bare bones approach to the covers for these manuals because it makes them look like a little more militaristic, like something you might get in like a military academy or something, just very straightforward, which I like.
Yeah, I like that too. In fact, I shot a little short science fiction film back in 2003 and these were on the set.
Oh, really? Props. I could see that. Yeah, these could be something you could imagine a cadet getting in officer training school or whatever. And I got to say, they're fun to read. You guys must have had fun writing these, because they are fun to read.
You know, I don't remember that they were fun to write, because I think when you're in the middle of it, you're just trying to make sure all the information is there. And, you know, we didn't have color printing that was available, so you have to figure out how you're going to do the screenshots and what, you know, density of blacks and grays you're going to use. And there was a lot of information, though. I remember at one point I went through, Tom gave me the source files for the text that was in Universe 2, and I ripped all the stuff out of what was the computer called in Universe 2? I don't remember. Oh, it was the Athena IRS interface. That's right. And I pulled all the text out of it, so I have this sort of Omnitrend Bible that I put together based on all that text with all these... Everything that happened in Universe 2 or could happen in Universe 2, I have all the text for. And we pulled from that a lot when we were coming up with backstory for the missions and, you know, little bits of detail to throw in the manuals to make the games feel connected to the previous games.
Right. Yeah, that would have been lost on me, I admit, because I didn't play the previous games. But there are times where I'll just pick these up and read them. Because they're almost as much fun to read as they are to play the actual game, so I have to say I love these manuals. Now, how much? Because one thing you just brought up are like company logos and stuff like that. There's so many little details in these games, like these little companies and the alien backgrounds and all this stuff. I mean, how much work went into that to come up with all these little details? Like Scion, for example.
Well, actually, that was probably the most fun, was, you know, detailing the story and the characters and the companies. I can remember a lot of sessions with Bill Leslie, specifically, sitting around one night drinking some beers and coming up with all these ideas for different alien races or different products that you could trade. And that was a lot of fun. That was probably the most, apart from the actual coding, which... I did, certainly in Rules of Engagement, I did all the coding. But back in the days when I was working with Bill Leslie, we pretty much each of us did about half the coding. Oh. That was a lot of fun, too. But just, you know, sitting around one night and coming up with ideas, just kind of blue-skying things, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I came in later, and of course, they had all these companies and stuff. So when Tom was making the builders for Rules of Engagement, we sort of went back to all that universe backstory and all those parts, and then I had to make up logos for all these companies. And, you know, some of them you just sort of think, okay, what's an interesting, you know, shape or something I can make related to this. The one I had the most fun with, of course, is the Dubois Auto Engineering Corporation, because there's this whole story about Mr. FX Dubois that's in Universe 2, I think, and how he discovered the planet Cetus Amicus and named it that because he thought... It looked like it means a happy whale. It has a whale-shaped continent, which you see in the in Rules of Engagement. There's an animation that shows that, and that he actually thought that the rumor has it he thought the planet. He actually tried to name it the Laughing Tuna, but his Latin was bad. This is the kind of stuff that Bill would write that I could never recreate. The sort of bizarre backstories for these things, and that stuff was fun to come up with. And so, of course, the logo for the Dubois Auto Engineering Corporation is a smiling whale.
Yeah, I remember.
And their products are mostly crap too. That's the other thing.
certainly, Bill's humor was scattered throughout all those early games, and very reminiscent of the type of humor that you'd see in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Ah.
So there's some silliness. But we did, you know, I mean, we certainly injected silliness in from time to time, but there was also an effort to try to make the games somewhat scientifically accurate, especially in the first game. And the first game has I can still remember Bill and I researching orbital mechanics and making sure that the ships orbited the planets properly. So you would, I can't, in my memory on this isn't really foggy now, but you would enter orbit around a planet, and I don't remember if you specified your orbital velocity or you specified what altitude you wanted to be at, but you would enter orbit at the appropriate altitude for your velocity, and then if you wanted to actually rendezvous with another ship, it actually went through a series of orbital calculations to figure out exactly how you could dock your ship with another ship by altering your orbital velocity.
Yeah, I'm kind of going through the manual for the first game, and there's a whole little section of navigation and orbits where you talk about this sort of thing. So
I don't think we bothered including that in this game, but that would have made it even more complicated. I remember us talking about whether or not the game should be 2D or 3D. And okay. Tom talking about how many calculations it would be, and finally said, you know what? If we make a 3D version of this game, nobody will ever be able to find another ship to fight. It's just, you know, you add that other plane, and like, oh, it's on the map, and people can't read three-dimensional maps very well, especially on a simple display like that.
Right.
That you'd think you were on top of an enemy ship, and it'd be a billion kilometers below you.
Yeah.
And you go, why couldn't I hit that? So that's why the game ended up being on a plane.
No, a lot of games do that, but it makes it more accessible. I mean, you have some spacey rivet counters complaining about that sort of thing, but I think it makes it more playable and accessible, so that's fine. I mean, you kind of have to do that, or else it's not fun. It just
Well, what I remember about the space stuff is, of course, I wasn't there on Universe when they were doing the orbital mechanics, but when we started working... Well, the thing I should say about the rules of engagement games, which is probably most people wouldn't realize, is a huge amount of the game design and production was building all the builders, which came first. Mm. So Tom would figure out what he needed the game to do. You know, he needs ships to do this and captains to do that. And we'd start building all the builders. So we used all the tools that are in the game because those were the things that were built first. So the solar system builder is the one we used. It wasn't like some add-on that we put on later. So huge amount of time was put up front designing all the component builders. And then when we got to the point of the solar system builder, I was actually out east working with Tom because I live on the West Coast and he's East Coast. And we went to the University of Hartford, and we went to the science department, and we went in and we pulled all these books on space and solar systems and stuff out, and we sat on the floor in the aisle pouring through these things, writing down spectral classes and how big the stars would be and what the surface temperatures would be and all that stuff, and like what are the orbits and all that stuff. And so, I mean, we literally went to the library to figure out all the stuff you could Google now. But we spent several hours just sitting on the floor in this library writing down, okay, now this book contradicts with this book about how big an M5 type, you know, star is and so forth. And that was a lot of fun to sort of put all that together. And then I found this old book called Habitable Planets for Man, which was published in 1965 by Stephen H. Dole by the RAND Corporation. All about how you would find inhabited, you know, where you would look for habitable planets. And all these rules for, like, what were the most likely stars and stuff. And that book was cited, and I used that to calculate the sizes of the planets so that you couldn't actually build a planet that would be habitable but wasn't habitable. So if the size limit is set by those things, the minimum and maximum size to have enough gravity to hold onto an atmosphere and all this stuff is based on, you know, what was known or projected at that time. So it's incredibly realistic in that level too, even if you don't realize it.
I guess I'm just thumbing through the solar system builder. There's a little hint here. It says, hint, realistically habitable planets should have a radius no greater than 7,800 and no less than 6,100 kilometers. I wonder how accurate that thinking is today.
Well, I think some of that is based for human beings anyway, because what it was in the book they talk about, based on G-force testing, that if you have a surface gravity greater than a certain amount, a human being's would suffer from heart failure because they'd be under too much strain all the time. And under a certain size, the atmosphere would tend to bleed off, like Mars. So, so you know, this cute little space game is really probably the closest thing to reality you've probably ever seen in a space game.
Yeah, I was always amazed at how much detail went to the builders. Do you guys know if a lot of people made their own missions back in the day? I tried finding some, and I couldn't find any on the internet. So, did you guys know if there were any people? If there were people making their own missions with these back in the day?
Well, I have a set of some of the guys who worked on. There's a zip file I have of some missions somebody made using like the little developer's kit Tom would let, you know, would sell people for Rules 2. And they even went through and they hacked the graphics and changed some of the graphics for all the captains and everything. So I could send you those.
Oh, that would be amazing. That would be awesome. Yeah, because
I totally forgot about that developer's kit. Yeah.
Now wait, what is this? I've never heard
about
of this.
Another game.
I've never heard of this developer's kit. What was this?
So the developer's kit was something that was not sold through distribution. I think it was something that I just sold directly to probably a handful of people who were interested in getting into a little bit more detail than just what you could do with the mission builders. As Murray said, for example, you could go in and you could modify the graphics. I don't remember all what it entailed, though, besides that.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't think I ever had a copy of it. So you're holding out on me, man.
That just blows my mind.
See if I can.
That just blows my mind that there are people who would be that willing. I'm not really surprised, just wonderful that there are people who are willing to go to that extra level and buy like an extra kit so they could do that. That just fascinates me that people can do, that people are up to doing stuff like that. I mean, I'm not much of a builder. I'm more of a, give me the mission, I'll play it, but I'm not much of a builder myself. Even so, I did build a test mission in the second game just to test it out, and it wasn't complicated at all. I mean, you guys did a good job of taking all this realism you were just talking about, but still making it streamlined and accessible enough that someone like me, who just has a basic modicum of knowledge, could still make a solar system. I could still make a mission in that solar system. So I gotta ask, how much work went into making all this accessible?
Well, like I said, I think a lot of it's just building the builders, and since Tom from the get-go, as we went to Breach, he wanted people to be able to build their own missions. We sort of, it was always from day one, you were trying to design something that somebody could use who wasn't, one of the developers, so it wasn't arcane. And, when I look at it, I would never design it this way now because I have a lot more experience.
Right.
And there are things that I think I tried to be a little too clever with the interface sometimes. In general, the builders, I think, are pretty simple for what they do. A little more hinting would have been nice. But, they're pretty straightforward. You go set the value for different parameters and, you plunk it in. And the solar system builder, you pick a planet size and it gives you a range that works. And the same, you move the star slider and it automatically changes the spectral type for you to what's correct for that size star. So you don't have to do all that research we did. You don't have to sit in the library for hours trying to figure out what a blue supergiant's diameter should be.
But if you want to read about it, I'm just looking at that section now. It's all here.
Yeah, I'm looking at it too. I'm looking at the star types, and there's, 8 star types, and they have all the radius range and the temperature ranges and the scales. And it's just, I wish they still made games like this. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I wish someone still made games like this.
But, well, they can buy the rights off Tom for a very, very hefty fee if they'd like. I'm sure you can negotiate. Call Omnitrend at...
Now Omnitrend still exists, I notice.
Yeah, it does still exist, but not doing computer games.
What's it doing now?
It is something totally different. It's involved in interfacing text messaging on pagers and cell phones with corporate email systems that use something called Microsoft Exchange Server. So some just highly specialized communications software. Sort of just a series of left and right turns that that got the company to there from computer games to there.
Well, what's kind of amazing is the company's still around. There are a lot of companies from back in those days that, you know, just don't exist anymore, sadly.
Yeah.
Or they just exist in name, like Atari. Or somewhere
it just went bankrupt again.
I know, and somewhere there's actually a MicroProse. Someone's actually using the name MicroProse, but not for anything good. So yeah, it's great that the company is still around. I mean, that's really a testament to how you've been able to change over the years. I mean, even though you're not doing games anymore, sadly, but you know, games have changed so much since the early '90s. That it's, I guess, like you said, it was really probably really difficult to keep up. I mean, they've gotten, I blame a lot of it on consoles. Honestly, I blame a lot of, especially space games decline on consoles.
Well, you know, here, this is a funny little segue, though, when you mention that, because somewhere between Rules of Engagement and Rules of Engagement 2, I was talking with Jim, and we were talking about where else this game could go. And we sort of took the idea, said, could you do a console game based on Rules of Engagement? If you could, how much could you simplify this game?
Wow.
And we'd actually done a breakdown of how you would simplify this game to run on a Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh, my God.
And I have that document around here somewhere. I actually ran into it a few months ago in one of my files. And what came out of that, though, was some of the things that ended up in Rules of Engagement 2 came out of that discussion because we were thinking, you don't have enough control. So we came up with the auto EBW by talking about having auto fire for a console game. So sometimes when you think about how to simplify something, it actually ends up adding, you go, oh, well, that makes total logical sense. Why the hell didn't we do that in the first place?
I got to say that auto EBW thing is pretty damned handy.
Yeah, one of the other things about the game, just things that pop into my head, was that we had the voice of the ship's computer, the ANDI computer, and my late friend Andy Morrison did the voice for that. And I liked her because she was from England, but she'd lived in the States for a long time. So to British people, she sounded American, and to American people, she sounded British. So she sounded foreign to everybody.
Yeah, she did have something of an accent in the game, I do recall.
Yes, yes. And I like that because nobody could pin where, you know, nobody was saying, oh, she sounds just like us. She sounded foreign to everyone. So
now, when you guys were working together, you were still on different coasts, even back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work? Because, like, there was email and stuff back then, but there weren't, like, the tools you had to collaborate that there are now. So how did that work for you guys?
Tom, you? Me?
Yeah, well, let's see. So there really was an email back in those days, right?
We did have email because we sent files to each other, but it wasn't a lot of it. I mean, I think towards the end we had simple email, but we were mostly doing modem to modem connects and uploading files to each other, I think.
Oh, wow. Did that?
Yeah, we might have been communicating over like CompuServe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember where we were because I had accounts on Delphi, which was for the Atari magazines I wrote for, and I had a MCI account or whatever it was. But I don't
know. There was also GE had a
Genie.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, this is one of those things. I'll bet you in one of my ancient email archives I could find some notes we passed back and forth. But you know, we were joking earlier about the moo joke and the cow joke, which I'll just quickly summarize. There was a character in the 1987 cartoon Mighty Mouse and New Adventures named the Cow, who mooed inadvertently whenever he was excited. And he was voiced by Michael Pataki, who was the Klingon who teases Scotty in The Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
And later on became the voice of George Licker for Ren and Stimpy.
He did not.
Same voice, basically.
That was that?
Yeah,
so, really?
I introduced Tom to these cartoons, so The moo joke came out of that. So to this day, I'll call him up and he'll say, you know, Omnitrend Software. I go, moo. And that's how he knows me. So the files we would send back and forth would be like bluemoo.zip and things like that. So it was just moo, moo, moo everywhere.
Oh, wow. But
that's the thing. It sort of gets back to the in jokes I told you about. Like I pointed out the one in the shipbuilder that you work on a game like this for over a year and you get a little tired of it, so you start doing stuff just to make it entertaining for yourself. So you start hiding things in the game or putting little in-jokes in the game. I know in the Captain Builder in Rules of Engagement, as you change their personality traits, the image changes, and they'll stick their hand out and refuse the bribe, or they'll take the bribe. And there's all these silly things that happen depending on what you set their personality traits to. So you slide the sliders and the captain's appearance changes. And that's just to be fun. That was just because I was bored. And Tom was bored enough to put the graphics actually in the game.
How did you guys get the faces in the game? I was curious about that because there weren't really photo scanners back then, were there?
Yeah, they actually – so that was in Rules 2, right?
Yep.
Where we actually had the real faces.
Yeah, that blew my mind at the time because I'd never seen
it. Yeah, so the way that worked was that was really before the days of digital cameras, or maybe digital cameras were out, but they were really expensive. So I would take pictures of people with a film camera, and then there was a service where you could send your film in to be developed, and they would send it back to you on a CD. And that's how we got those pictures. We literally had to mail it away, wow, and wait, you know, several weeks and get a CD back in the mail and hope the pictures look good.
Yeah, and Tom provided most of those photos, and actually Tom's in there. I think you're one of the fleet captain photos, and so is your wife.
Yep, yep.
And I'm in there as one of the captains, and a bunch of other people. And one of the things we really tried to do is make sure that we didn't just have a bunch of white people.
Yeah.
Because we were both sick of seeing that, so you'll notice there's quite a mix, you know, of types, and we wanted to make sure there were a lot of women, and it wasn't just a bunch of pasty white guys, you know. In fact, that even went to the into the game when we had some of the guys. I think it was like Haywood Nichol. Was it Haywood Nichols? I'm trying to remember his name. Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And these guys, a bunch of these guys made missions and ships and stuff, and then they, you know, they turned them into us. And I looked on the list of ships and captain names, and they were all very Western. So I went and did a bunch of research and renamed a bunch of the ships to be international, you know.
Yeah, I noticed that, which is very cool.
So they'd be like one of them's named after the oldest known Chinese village, you know, and things like that. Just because, again, we didn't want it to feel really like, you know, it's these are all people from the United States in space.
Right. No, that's awesome. I really appreciated that, how you had all these different – because the captain names were all very ethnic. They were all over the place and stuff.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
In fact, there's a couple of in-jokes in there, too. I think one of them is it's like a Zambian rite of circumcision, I think is what one of the ship names translates to.
Well, guys, to wrap this up, I'm going to ask a very loaded question. Because we've been talking for almost an hour, which is great. I don't want to keep you guys too long. But I'm going to ask a loaded question. Now, if you guys were doing this today, or if you guys had the opportunity to kickstart a Rules of Engagement 3, for example, where would you start? What would you do, you know, to make it not only keep it to the spirit of the original, but maybe make it more modern for modern audiences? Because I'm sure there are some people out there like myself who would love a Rules of Engagement 3, even if it never happens. But I think it's fun to think about and dream about, so I wanted to ask you guys about that. Like, if you could make it today, if you could make a new one today, how would you go about it?
Who goes
so
first?
I'll take it first.
Oh, Bruce.
And so in looking through the manual, just thumbing through it, I have this incredible desire to want to play this game right now, but I know that as soon as I bring it up on the screen, I'm going to be disappointed in the graphics. I'm probably going to be very disappointed in the fact that it's 2D only. But I think the underlying concept of this game is really cool. And I would love to see Rules of Engagement 3 be very similar to this, but done with modern graphics, modern resolutions, and the ability to do the game truly in 3D. And be able, you know, obviously with the sophisticated graphics processors now, I'm sure that there's a way that we could design this so that it could be understandable and playable in three dimensions.
Totally.
And by the way, Maurice, I'm going to probably retire in about 15 years. So as a retirement project,
maybe all right, well, you should move out to the wine country and we'll retire together and we'll make a game on the side.
Okay. Oh my God. That's totally going to hit you guys up in 15 years.
my comment would be, and I agree with Tom about this, but you know, every time I look at the games, I feel like when we got the Rules of Engagement 2, I made a miscalculation on the interface. What happened was, and you know, Tom may or may not agree with this, is we had a lot of hardcore players who gave us a lot of good feedback on the first game, but we sort of catered to that, I think, a little too much. So the second game, I think, becomes too complicated. I think there's a barrier to entry to somebody who hasn't played the first game. The number of panels you can flip around, the amount of data that gets thrown at you, the fact that you have to actually build you have to build your mission. I mean, you have to like go deploy your ships and put your captains on them. There's no sort of way to jump right in and play it.
Yes.
I think it's a problem. And we should have had an auto deploy feature where it used all of Tom's smarts in terms of, you know, the captain stuff, but use it to assign captains and ships. So for a player who isn't interested in that level of minutia, they could just say auto deploy and go right in there and do it. But to me, that was the one miscalculation in the second game. I thought we let it get too complicated, and part of that's my fault for coming up with this overly clever interface. But that's really it, and I agree with Tom otherwise. I think 3D, and I would do a lot more stuff kind of haptically. You'd be able to see the target with all this information coming off of it rather than having all these kind of arcane buttons.
Right.
But you know, so much of what this game's look was defined by the fact that we were dealing with a 320 by 200 pixel screen.
Right.
And I had to develop a font that worked in like 3 by 5 pixels, you know.
It's still very
so. It was pretty nightmarish. I remember a lot of times the panels were dictated by how the labels would fit on the buttons.
Wow. Now, one last question. I just thought of this. This would be kind of like a perfect tablet game because it's kind of based on a touch interface. Don't you guys think?
Yeah, I actually did get to play it on a touch screen once. I worked for a company and they were doing games for those bar and restaurant machines.
Oh, yeah. You
know, and we had one of those in our office, and I was able to get, because it was a PC-based thing, I got Rules running on it. And it was actually fun because you were actually able to tap the screen and operate it the way you ought to be able to. That would be a lot of fun because, you know, that's sort of the whole idea was to be a touchscreen interface that we had to give you a fake hand to do.
Yeah, maybe think of bringing it to tablets or something. I think it might do well on an iPad. If you scale it
in
up
15
a
years.
Bit. Yeah, in 15 years. But that would be such a great game to play on a touchscreen. Oh my God. Okay.
So my big concern about doing such a project would be is there really a big enough market for it is there a market for a really complicated strategy game like this?
I think you'd be surprised because I've noticed like certain Kickstarters for complicated space games totally get funded. I mean, I still think there is an audience out there for it. It might not be as big as other audiences. It might not be as big as it used to be. But I think there is an audience. I mean, I would want to play these games. And I get a decent amount of readers to this site of mine. So
yeah, I still work in games, and I work in, you know, mobile gaming. And as I said earlier, the word is always discoverability. And you live or die by the ability of people to find your game when there's like 80,000, you know, iPad apps out there.
Right.
And, you know, so you one of the things you have to work really hard at on these things besides the game is actually getting the game out there and making sure people are aware of it and trying to get your fans to spread that information around virally. So it's a really interesting space because, you know, even big companies with lots of budgets often make titles that nobody ever sees. So it's really tricky. Though the Kickstarter idea is smart because at least you'd have a base of people who would be aware of it because they invested in it and they would be your core, you know, buyers, at least initially.
Yeah, Kickstarter has been something of a boon for space gaming over the last year or two. It's been very awesome seeing all these little projects getting funded.
Yeah.
So I think it would be great to see, you know, maybe Rules of Engagement, maybe a remix version, maybe an upscaled version coming. But this is just a dream. This is just me dreaming out loud. Well,
we can always do the Nintendo Entertainment System version of it on a mobile phone.
I would actually love to read that document if you ever come across that again.
I have a hard copy of it here. I just saw it the other day. I was going to pull it out for this, and I think I filed it again, but I'll pull it out and scan it for you.
If you have that time, I would. I think my readers too would also love to read that kind of thing. Because
I still have some of the original sketches for the game too. I have like the sketches. Like I was on a bus when I came up with the idea of the quad panel interface and that center bar, and I think I still have the original pencil drawing of that from 1992 or whatever it was.
Oh my god, you guys are like rich in history for this stuff. You guys gotta scan this stuff and send it over, because seriously, I kind of want this site to be a love letter to space games throughout history. You know, that's part of why I'm doing this. And just having
Tom, there's a place to get rid of your excess inventory.
Believe it or not, I do still have original shrink wrapped copies of pretty much every game. Small quantities, sometimes just two or three left.
Oh my god.
But they are there. And not quite sure exactly what to do with them. I mean, they're sort of valuable. They're probably more valuable to me than anyone else. Well, but
if you're willing to part with at least one of those original copies of Universe, we could talk after.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the manual came in is really sweet. It even has a little kickstand, so it stands up, so you can have the manual standing in front of you while you play the game.
It has a kickstand in a manual.
Yeah.
It's actually real cool. So it's a three ring binder, right? It's a padded three ring binder, which is really nice. And so if you imagine that you open up the binder so it lays flat,
right?
The cover, both the front cover and the back cover are hinged, and it can actually fold outwards to make a little kickstand. And so the manual will actually sit upright on the desk. And the idea was that you could have the manual there and you could flip through the pages as you're playing the game and kind of have it as a reference.
It
was really nice. That was an expensive package to do. I think when that game came out, we sold it for $89.95.
Yeah, like $90.
Half of that cost was the binder.
Yeah. But like I said, if you are willing to part with one of those, we'll talk after this. Because, oh my god, I would love to have that.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
I'll have to do a real inventory, find out what exists, and then we can talk down the road and see what I got.
Yeah, I'm sure. I bet you that money. I bet you money. There would be actual people who would want to buy these.
I'm sure there is. It's just it's I don't know how many I have left of everything, and once it's gone, it's gone. So I don't know. I'm kind of a pack rat, so I've got, you know, basically all of the original, like Maurice does. I have a lot of the original development notes and things like that still.
Yeah, so, I think I always pull from the past. You know, like I'll do something. Like I said, I reuse those manuals on a film set once. So, you know, I'm big on repurposing stuff. It's like, I've done that work already once. Why would I do it again?
Well, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure to talk to you both. This has been a real, just a total treat for me. And I want to thank you guys for being willing to take over an hour now out of your day to talk to me about this over 20-year-old series of games.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it's always great to talk to Tom. We actually still do talk to each other on a relatively frequent basis, but it's nice to catch up on things like this.
Yeah, we haven't reminisced about the games in a long time, so this has been a great deal of fun.
Yeah, I honestly can't wait to see the comments that come out of this, because I have a decent amount of readers that have been around in space games longer than I have, surprisingly. And so I'm just fascinated to read what people have to say about this.
Well, I'll send you some graphics and stuff you can post from the development of the stuff, because I just found one that's really funny. Bill Leslie sent me a sketch for Universe 3 where the where the art was supposed to be for a grid, and he drew what we call PR art, PRART, which is programmer art. And so it's his really crude sketch of where the character should be, and then my finished graphic next to it. So
that would be fantastic.
It's a pretty funny image.
I think it's probably appropriate also to mention Bill Leslie again, because you know, I mean, his input was as valuable, if not more, especially in the early days, than Maurice and myself. So, you know, although he's not in this interview, he certainly deserves his share of credit as well.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Is he still around? Is he still kicking?
Oh yeah, he's still around. I still see him on Facebook, so he's out there.
Really? I would kind of like to talk to him too at some point. I think that might be fun.
If you think we're funny, wait.
Well, I'm going to look out for him then. Because I'd like to talk to him, too. But, gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm going to hit the stop recording button in a second. But I just wanted to thank Thomas. How do you guys say your names? Thomas Carbone. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Maurice, I hope I say your last name right, Molyneux?
Molyneux.
Okay. Thomas Carbone, Maurice Molyneux, two of the guys who worked on the original Rules of Engagement games, and Thomas, who worked on the Universe games that came before it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to put this online. And
all right, thank you.
Great, thank you, Brian.
And I'm stopping recording now.
Bye.